Hi, and welcome to episode 116 of the Clive Barker Podcast. The episode today is with Simon Sace, puzzle box creator and special effects guru, who was part of Image Animation during Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2 and Nightbreed. So before we get started on that, I just wanted to say that this episode, we're proud to be sponsored by Jordy Calendar. So Jordy is a very customizable calendar and organizer with icons, themes, wallpaper, and settings available to make your calendar look the way that you want. If you have an iPhone or iPad, it can sync to your default iOS calendar, so you don't have to enter in appointments separately. If you don't have an iPhone, it's also available on Android. If you use Google Calendar, it can sync to your Google Calendar events, and they also have their own cloud service called Jordy Cloud to keep your calendars and events backed up. Jordy has a unique feature that's called Calendar Events, where you can follow like sports and other things. Like they have a special one for the horror blog Shock Till You Drop. You can follow them. You can look at the weather forecast, and there are many other event calendars available on Jordy. So to add them, just tap on the calendar icon in the lower left toolbar, and then tap on Add Event Calendar and browse or search directly and add any event calendar you're interested in. So we'd love you to give Jordy a try. Of course, it's free to try. Search for it now in the App Store or Google Play. It's spelled J-O-R-T-E, Jordy. Use the custom link, bit.ly/pinheadcalendar. That's our custom link, so they'll know that you heard about it from the Clive Barker Podcast, and we thank them for their support. Okay, so back to episode 116. This is with Simon Sace. Jose and Rob and I had a long talk with him, and at first, due to his health, we were a little concerned, and also he had warned us that we may have to cut it off after about half an hour. But that ended up not happening, and we, you know, stuck it out for a good hour and a half or so. So here it is, puzzle box creator and special effects guru, Simon Sace. Yeah, welcome. This is episode 116 of the Clive Barker Podcast. We've got special guest Simon Sace, the creator of the puzzle box from Hellraiser and Image Animation.
Hello. Yes, indeed. Hi.
It's great to talk to you. It's on a personal note, I want to say I'm very happy to be able to chat with you because I've always admired your work in Hellraiser, and I also found out that you design other stuff for some other movies that I love, but especially the Lament configuration. It's been such an iconic horror artifact. It's almost akin to Freddy's glove or Jason's mask, only much better looking with an almost otherworldly clockwork aesthetic. So it's beautiful.
And one thing you'll kind of notice is that I think no matter how bad the Hellraiser sequels get, there are two things that they always want to keep the same. One is that there's a puzzle box, you know, following that same design, and then the other is the Pinhead. You know,
those are the only things that stay the same.
The two consistent things across all 10 movies so far.
Yes, of course. Well, you definitely can't ignore Pinhead, can you? And, I think the puzzle box has just become something that they build the stories around.
Yeah, exactly. They can even take a script from that's not a Hellraiser script and throw a puzzle box and Pinhead into it and make it a Hellraiser movie.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. I'm going to go away after this phone call and do that. I'm going to make
Would you like to tell us a little bit about how you came up with the design for the box? I know that there has been a great documentary, which I totally recommend, from Gary Smart and other people who we've had on the podcast before. It's, of course, I'm talking about the documentary Leviathan. There's a segment where you explain everything with visual aids. But would you tell us a little bit of the story about how you got approached to make the Hellraiser box?
It was pure luck. I was a working artist. I'd been to art college. I was one day I watched a film called Harvey with James Stewart about a big invisible white rabbit. Mm-hmm. And in the film, I guess the film was made in the 30s or something like that, maybe 40s. They look up what Harvey is in an encyclopedia, and Harvey was a spirit. He was a pooka, and I went into one of the Oxford libraries just to see if a pooka really did exist, if you like to call it existing, and found out that it was one of a series of mythical little people that can change shape. And I then came up with the concept of creating a range of leprechauns, if you want, or derivations of those, which I put into bottles around about 12 inches high. And I gave them the real history behind each one, which I researched in Oxford. I sold them at there's a market in London called Camden Lock, which gets, it's a big artistic haunt. And I used to, once a week go and sell my hobgoblins, as I called them, down at Camden Lock, and they were pretty successful immediately. I used to sell out regularly, and one day a guy called Bob Keane turned up, and he bought a hobgoblin, and he asked me if I'd be interested in doing some work on a film, Hellraiser, which was all a bit weird because I had nothing to do with the film industry. It's one of those things you don't actually think you can get jobs in the film industry. It's it's one of those sort of mythical things almost. Mm-hmm. So I said yes. We had a few phone calls and chats, and he said he's working with a guy called Clive Barker, who I'd never heard of. So I'd never heard of Bob Keane, never heard of Clive Barker, and pretty much didn't know my way to Shepperton Studios. And they said, yeah, we're starting in, I think it was 2 months' time, 3 months' time, we're going to start on pre-production. And so I immediately threw away all my molds, decided I was going to make a lot of money in the film industry, and then spent 6 months with no money coming in because I had forgotten that the film industry is notoriously rubbish with its start times. So that was it. It was pure luck and happenstance that Bob Keane turned up and saw my work and said, "Do you want to become part of the team?"
Excellent.
Cool story.
When I was a teacher in a little Arctic village in Nightmute, they believed that there were little people there. I mean, it was just common belief. Like, why would you even question it? And they were kind of like leprechauns that would, like, if you ran out of gas on your snowmobile, they would fill up your gas tank for you so you could keep going.
Look, I mean, I don't doubt it. I mean, when I get into this sort of stuff, I kind of absorb myself. So there were leprechauns, there were chloricorns, there were bogarts.
Oh, wow.
There were Kublai, which were little goblins that worked down the mines in Wales, and the miners would take down a gift of a little bit of food when they went down there. And on the Isle of Wight, which is just off the south coast of England, if you go into any cottage over, I don't know, 300-400 years old, you'll find that there's a hole in the side of the cottage, and that was so that when you locked up your house, you didn't lock one of the little people into your house by mistake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
So these things exist in people's minds, and even when I was selling the little hobgoblins in jars, I didn't get many letters, but I maybe got two or three letters over a period of a couple of years from people who bought them and said, since we bought your little hobgoblin, my son's whooping cough has gone away, and I bought it because this one was known for curing whooping cough. And you kind of thought,
wow.
Oh, yeah, really? Okay, fine. To be totally honest, my mum still speaks to little people. She goes into her cellar and she has a chat with them.
Nice.
I hate to tell her.
Well, you mentioned the Pooka and Harvey. And, for example, the Pooka has been in several movies. I mean, Donnie Darko has a giant rabbit called Frank. You got Day of the Lepus. You got all these movies that talk about giant rabbit monsters. It's part of a certain folklore, and it does emerge in movies every once in a while.
Yeah, it's a nice thing. I think it's nice if there's a thread, especially in a horror film, if there's a thread that goes back to something that's not necessarily dark and scary.
It's my understanding that you also designed, in other movies like Nightbreed, you came up with the design for Deckard's Mask, which is another iconic villain in the horror genre.
Mm-hmm. I think it's wrong to say I came up with it. The box, the Lament configuration, obviously was very much Clive's idea, but because of the nature of the way the movie was made, I pretty much designed it at home in Oxford on my own.
Of course, people know in The Hellbound Heart it was a black lacquered box.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there was a story that you guys tried that and it just didn't look good on film. Is there any truth to that?
I don't think it was tried. No.
Oh, okay.
I think it was probably pointed out to me that
we
couldn't make it. I mean, the box was lacquered. The box had about three or four layers of lacquer on every side, but it was a matte lacquer,
you apply it one side at a time, right?
Yes. Oh my god.
So yeah. It multiplied the workload to six times.
You got no idea. I don't even have an original box. I was so sick and tired of them. I pretty much gave them away. I think Clive's got one. Bob probably has one. I gave one to Jeff. I gave one to pretty much any member of the crew who walked by me.
Oh, that's cool.
And but I don't have one myself. But going on from that. So on the box, I've got no problem taking credit for the design and the detail, because it was all done away from Shepperton Studios. It was done in Oxford and researched at the Pitt Rivers Museum, and a place I still
frequent probably twice a month in terms of just doing research on different projects. But when it came to Decker's mask, I think Clive had a pretty good image in his head of exactly what he wanted. Sure.
Buttons for eyes and stuff like that.
Yeah, so and everything from I want it slightly offset and blah, blah, blah. And so I was working to a pretty tight brief, which came from Clive on the mask. Obviously, as the artist and the sculptor, you play with it, move things around, exaggerate things, and hopefully bring something to the equation that Clive either didn't have or just didn't have the time to do. You know, he was running around directing his first big movie. And so...
Was it maybe two pieces, like the mask and the cowl, and then put together?
Sorry, say again?
Was it made in two pieces, like the face and the cowl, and then put them together when you apply them?
No, I mean, the mask was made just as a mask with a zip at the back.
Okay, gotcha.
I can't even remember how many I made of them. They became quite horrible, smelly places to be after a couple of days shooting. A director like David Cronenberg doesn't like smelly rubbish being put on his head every day.
Yeah.
I know, yeah. I had a double that did a lot of those scenes.
Yeah. I mean, if it was an unknown actor hidden behind it, then you say, shut up and put up with it. But David Cronenberg...
Yeah. You can't say that to him.
I remember seeing the deluxe set of the Nightbreed Director's Cut where several members of Image were reminiscing about the Berserker suits. And that... They had to put them on when they still had the sweat of the actors who had been on them the whole day just to do a few extra reshoots. And they didn't even have time to dry them out, so they had to just put those soggy things on and go and do some more shoots. And
We did a terrible film once called The Unholy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 19- yes.
With Ben Cross.
Ben Cross, yeah, he was in it, playing a priest.
Yeah. And we had to reshoot the end of the movie, and I think Bob directed it in this out in LA. And so myself and Little John, John Cormacan, mm-hmm. and Neil Gorton were in charge of sculpting this monster, and. I pulled the short straw and was actually in the suit.
Oh, wow.
And it was just a horrible thing. In that particular case, it wasn't a clever monster. It was a bit like the cow from hell. I was the front half of the donkey, if you want, and my feet were strapped to the back of the guy behind me, and he was bent over, and then I had to walk on stilts with the weight of this animatronic head on my back, and I had to walk down the aisle of a church for the end of the film. And I think there must have been about 16 people hidden behind each aisle, because after three or four steps I'd fall over and fall into one of the aisles, and someone would catch me, and it was all edited out. But nevertheless, that was a horrible, smelly place to be, especially when you were upside down.
Oh, I'll bet. So how was it like to work at Image Animation? I've read a lot of funny stories about the shop and someone setting fire to some sort of solvent, and then everybody had to open the windows to get all the smoke out. And it must have been really fun to do that. I remember seeing a picture that had like a dummy on the door of the shop holding like a sign. And it seemed like a really fun place to work at the time.
I think it was a brilliant place and a brilliant atmosphere. Definitely in the early days.
A lot of imaginations going around, you know, going around ideas. It seemed like a lot of those guys were into that, you know, just, you know, coming up with cool looking creatures, something that's really missing, I think, from film today.
Yeah, sometimes it wasn't even about being cool. I kind of think the interesting thing was that some of us had been brought into image animation who didn't come from a film background. So Little John didn't come from a film background.
Mm-hmm.
He started on the same day as me, and basically we spent 2 or 3 years just waiting for the tap on the shoulder to say, what are you doing here, mate? Mm. And but as a result of that, we brought in different thought processes, which was interesting. So I think there were a couple of you'll probably know this better than I. There were a couple of very important special makeup effects magazines going around at the time that everybody who knew anything about makeup effects bought. I can't even remember what they were called. And I didn't read them. So when somebody said, you have to sculpt this or do a makeup on someone for this way, I never... There was no traditional place for me to go, so I would always start by probably going down the wrong road, if you like. And that worked quite well, because obviously you've got your great makeup artists like Jeff Portas, who would come along and say, no, this is what you need to do. And I'd be going, well, I've just spent 2 days going down this route. It's the wrong route. But in fact, halfway down that wrong route, you discover something else. And so image animation was, I guess it was almost a bit like a rock band in some ways, you know, where ideas were just being thrown around and you're discarding the traditional routes. I mean, yeah, the box is a good example. There is no way nowadays that a designer would be given the freedom and leeway. I think I had about 2 months at home with my large architectural drawing board, going into Oxford, doing some research, taking photographs, getting them printed out, and then doing this in pen and ink very slowly and carefully. And subsequent boxes that have been designed by other people, you can tell they probably had 2 days to get the design out rather than 2 months.
Right.
And so
also they work from your original design. They kind of reverse engineer it and use elements of the original box to come up with their own interpretations of the box, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. But yes, yeah. But going back to the image animation thing, it was like working in a sweet shop. We used to get in at 8 o'clock every morning, and a lot of us took in sleeping bags because we'd rather just keep sculpting.
Right?
Yeah. Oh wow.
It was a it was a wonderful, you know, you were surrounded by clever people, just clever, brilliant people. And you didn't know it, and then you'd have people like Dave Keane, who's Bob's brother, and Jason Reed, Ian Rolfe. They were all in the engineering section, and they did stuff with radio controls and cables that would blow most people away. And then you had the likes of Nigel Booth and John and Jeff, who were just brilliant sculptors. And you're sitting there thinking, why am I here? They're surely they're going to kick me out soon. somehow you kind of squeezed by every day and got in the next morning and thought, okay, I'll keep my head down, put the headphones on, and I'll sculpt this mask. I don't know what it's going to look like. And see what happens from there. And also remember, I wasn't a makeup artist. So, on the first film, Hellraiser, they probably recognized it. They probably thought, okay, look, we've got Simon here. He's a bit of a nerd. And tell you what, let's give him a box to make. And he can do that for two films. So they were making monsters and angels from hell, and I was doing a bloody box.
almost 30 years later, I mean, look at the box. It's still so widely recognized. It's such an integral part of the whole Hellraiser mythology. I would say that you had every right as an artist to be recognized for that.
One of the sequels really focused on the box, and that was Bloodline.
Oh, yeah.
That's true, yeah. Yeah. They brought back the toy maker and showed how the box was made.
Yeah. I think I saw it. I saw it online. And
you're not missing out on much.
yeah, that's sort of what I gathered, which is why when I revisited the box last year and produced not a new box, but a reimagining of the box. You've probably seen them. They're made out of wood. They're burnt.
Oh, yeah. Your amazing product, the Lament Configuration Obscurita box.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. So it's just a revisiting of the same thing and almost taking it backwards. So it's not shiny. It's almost like the box before it became the box, if you will. So it was nice to revisit the design from that aspect, I think. And we're still playing with it. I was lucky enough when I made the original etching, the brass etching for the box. It was etched by a company in Oxford, and part of the printing process is they give the artist a copy of the etching before the print run starts. And they gave me one, and I kept it. And it's 6 feet away from me now. And that's been the basis for every piece of renewed artwork I've done relating to the box, because we can scan it now in awesomely high resolution and play with it a bit more.
And we'll have notes on the show notes also to where people can find those.
Did you have any other symbols in mind for the box, other than, like, you know, the beautiful woman, the crouching man, or was that pretty much just something that was Clive wanted?
No, Clive didn't know about them.
Oh, he didn't? Oh, okay.
In fact, nobody knew about them. The only one that they knew about was
I didn't know about him until I watched this recent documentary, to be honest with you. That was the first time I learned of him.
The only one I knew about was the engineer when the box is solved.
Yeah, I didn't even know that one.
Yeah, that was the engineer. That sort of blew me away a bit, really, because my wife at the time was a maths teacher, and she was specializing in trigonometry and how shapes put together and things. And as I said, I was at home signing the box, and so I was able to talk to her about what sort of shapes we could do and change and things. And the original change from a box to a star, if you want, was just done with a piece of cardboard and a pin through the middle just to see if it worked. And then you go, yes, this works. It actually does work. You can actually change the shape of a box into this. But of course, then I had to work out how you, if you're doing it two-dimension with a piece of cardboard, that's one thing. When you're actually doing it with wood and you have to change a 3-inch by 3-inch box into a different shape, it became something of a nightmare. But in terms of the icons within it, I was very happy with the engineer. I really liked that.
I actually own a star box that's made of wood with the brass things and stuff, and then you can just pull it out and reorient it and put it back into the solved position. It's really fascinating to see the care and attention to detail that was put into the engineer shape. And not many people, I think, notice it. But now that Leviathan is out, I'm sure people will be able to look and track all the beautiful women, the crouching man, Frank Cotton's face. So that was great to see that segment on Leviathan. I bet that was really fun to make.
Actually, I was, as you can probably tell, I was very ill during the making of that, and pretty much didn't wasn't really about to turn up. I'm far better now, by the way. So it was very enjoyable, and the team behind Leviathan. Very nice people. In fact, they came down to Oxford and we had lunch only a couple of weeks ago.
Have you watched the entire Leviathan documentary?
No one has watched the entire.
That's a good one. We watched all 11 hours of.
Yeah, we did for the set, to do an episode about it.
I could have gone for another 11 hours, to be honest, because that's just so fascinating.
So much cool stuff.
I believe they brought out one has been brought out, which is edited down to about 2 hours.
Yeah.
And
on the Scarlet Box that they released by Arrow Video, they've separated their Hellraiser disc has 1 hour, and Hellbound has the second hour.
Right. It was a bit like they just couldn't afford an editor.
So in Hellbound, I think I've talked to someone who was an image animation. Her name was Anna Levat, and I think that she told me that she remembers working with you and your brother making boxes for Hellbound, because your brother was also working in image animation, Warwick, and Nightbreed as well. So how was that process in Hellbound? I'm sure it was more streamlined at the time because you already had done a lot of work for Hellraiser. So
yeah. Anna, pretty much, I've got to say that nobody did boxes apart from me. This was my life, you know. I was stuck in the corner doing boxes. I don't think Anna, who I know, and again, you know, she came down about 6 months ago and we had lunch. I don't think she actually worked on the boxes, although she did make her squishy box, which you probably see.
Yeah, she donated one to us for one of our fundraisers.
Excellent.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. She didn't actually work on the box. The box didn't really... It really was a one-man operation because you had to be pretty anal and absorbed in what the box was in order to do anything. It was very much a one-man operation. I hardly remember anything else that went on with the film because I would be sniffing in the things I was covering the box with and,
picking it up when the actors dropped it.
Yes, bastards.
Well, yeah. And I think that you've kind of answered this question already, but David Anderson had asked, he said many years ago there was a puzzle box maker who said he interviewed Bob Keane and supposedly said that some of the symbols on the box came from a book Clive Barker had on Mesopotamia. And he relayed that info a couple of times before, and he realized the guy could have been making stuff up in order to sell more puzzle boxes. So he just wanted to run that question by you and see what your response was.
No.
Okay.
That's the long answer.
Yeah.
So returning to the Obscurita box, you have a series of lithographic prints about to come out soon as well, right?
Yeah, we're working on it. I pretty much walked away from the whole Hellraiser thing for 25 years. I went and worked in advertising and writing and in Formula One engineering. And it was pretty much when I got diagnosed as being ill. My partner Kathy looked at some of the stuff that was online, and it was inaccurate, and I thought it might be time if I wasn't going to be around much longer to at least put the record straight and put some stuff online and talk to some people. And then of course Gary Smart and the Leviathan crew came along at the right time, and so I was able to put the record straight there, and then I was able to revisit it, and there's the Obscurita box. But I also, as I said, I do have this original etching, and I love artwork, and I love engineering, and what we're doing is we're producing, or I'm producing. No, it is we, because I can't actually operate the machine. We're using an old 1930s printing press called a Heidelberg, and we are going to be producing a limited edition run of lithographs on the Heidelberg. If we can make it operate without it taking our arms off, it's a dangerous machine. But we're using lovely, lovely old printing technology.
Is that eight color?
No, it's not.
Okay.
No, it's going to be black ink on paper that. The paper we're probably going to use is actually from America. It's called from a company called Cranes and Co. And it's made out of 100% cotton. And the company traces its roots back to before the American Civil War.
Wow.
So it becomes I'm not going to knock something out just to have another print of another box out there. So I've got to have a story behind anything I do, because obviously it's important to me.
It's going to set a standard. For the box, we usually say that the artist puts blood, sweat, and tears into his work, but you actually went ahead and you actually put some of your own blood into it. You want to tell us how that went?
Yeah. It's a bit sick, isn't it?
Not at all.
I like that idea. No, that's a great idea.
There is a Brazilian artist who just paints in blood. It's interesting stuff, but he gave himself a collapsed lung by doing it. So you do have to be a bit careful. My cancer treatment means that every 3 weeks I have blood taken. Mm-hmm. When I started coming up with the concept of the artwork, I would ask for an extra vial or two. I get my blood taken every 3 weeks, I ask for extra vials to be given to me, I thought they weren't going to do, but eventually they decided that it's my blood and I can do what I want with it. I keep it in the fridge, and it doesn't need much. Strange enough, blood goes far further than you'd think on a piece of artwork. I thought with the boxes, I would just, because you can't sign an obscurita box because it's very highly textured, the best way of signing it is just to add some blood. And then, of course, when you photograph it with a flash, the blood flashes back, which is quite nice. I also use the blood on... I very rarely, but I do produce 3-foot by 2-foot canvas pieces of artwork on about the box. One is on a black background, and one is on a cream antique background. And Clive has two of those hanging in his house, and I do splatter blood on them. Probably a bit more heavier than I do on a box, but it's quite nice. It means that in 100 years you can, check for a forgery in terms of signature. You'll be able to actually check the DNA of a piece of.
That's
pretty cool.
Completely unfakeable. Yeah.
Good point.
I think I know the author, the painter that you were talking about earlier. I think it's Vicente Castillo.
Yes. And
he talks about blood being like the psychic force. And it's his artwork is amazing. And I remember, especially maybe Ryan or Rob, you might be aware of this. Marvel Comics did a special issue of involving the band Kiss. And the gimmick for that comic book, I think this was from the 80s, was that each of the member of the band Kiss had donated like a small vial of blood, and they had added the blood into the ink for the printing process. And so it was like
I think you told us this before.
Yeah.
So I remember that. It's not unheard of for artists to sign in their own blood.
Well, that's quite interesting because I'm going to steal that idea off you now, if you don't mind. When we do the lithographic prints, I'll take a vial or two of my blood and we'll put them into the core ink.
Brilliant.
Take it from there. That'd be really fantastic. Do you mind if I do that?
No, of course not.
That's awesome.
Yeah, do it.
No, thank you very much. Okay, that's brilliant. I'm really, yeah. I'm glad about that because I didn't have enough blood to do each one individually,
right.
Not without passing out. And so this is going to be a way around that.
That's cool. And Steve Dillon had a question that he wanted Jose to ask you.
Okay. He says, question for Jose to ask Simon Stacey on the Kleibarker podcast. Are there any plans for a book of the man who did the art for the box from that movie? I would buy that.
Yes, I responded to that on Facebook and said I'd buy it too.
Right.
No, I think it'd be a very boring book, to be totally honest. I mean, there are some amazing artists out there. Do you all know of Eric? Eric?
Yeah, Gross? Eric Gross.
Yeah.
Actually, if I can go ahead and say this, I actually designed one box for the Pyramid Gallery once.
Wow.
It was never produced because it was a strange-looking design. It was a design that I attributed to having been discovered by Rasputin the monk. I know, this was written years ago, so you know, bear with me here. But the whole box, it was shaped like a Star of David, and I called it Filigree and Shadow. So it's somewhere in the Pyramid Gallery website, and you know, there's a design, there's a story that I came up with. That was the extent of my contribution.
I think that one of the wonderful things, sorry, I didn't mean to say wonderful about my own work, but one of the wonderful aspects of the box is that people can take it and personalize it their own way, do their own things with it.
Sure.
You Star of David, absolutely, and of course Eric's work on his Pandora book is fabulous. I've got to write a foreword for the next one, I believe. I've been told I have to.
Oh wow! Cool.
I've also I've written what my interpretation of the history of the original box is.
Wow.
Because it essentially, if you want to go back to my research in Pitt Rivers, it's not a Chinese puzzle box, because if you look at the beginning of the film, you have a Chinese or Asian man with the dark fingernails, but he's not in China. And he actually looks like he's in an Arab country.
Yeah, like a czar or someplace like that.
Exactly. And the artwork and the stuff in the background, if you look at it, it is quite interesting, but it's not Oriental. So I did a backstory based on my original research, which linked the making of the box by Le Marchand to the whole French colonial empire at the time. And the French colonial empire covered France, and it covered Arabia, and it covered India, I believe. Mm. And of course, and for a while, It did go very far east, but only for a short time. And so I liked the idea that there was a story behind the design of the box that was related to one person's journey, as opposed to a simple thing. Sorry, I'm wondering. I don't know why where that came from.
No, that's great.
That's really cool.
Is it going to be published somewhere? You were talking about Eric Gross and his followers of the Pandorix, and then you went into this story. Right. So is that going to be part of any project that's published?
Yeah, I think there's potential for... I'd like to write it, and it may go as some sort of pamphlet. It may go as a foreword to somebody else's book. I'm not going to write it to publish it. But I moved from the film industry to the writing industry for a long time. And in fact, I won the International Screenwriters Award for a film that never got made.
Oh, wow.
So
you had two movies option, right?
Yeah, that's right, yes. One was called The Hitmen, which was about two out-of-work actors who get muddled up as being two hitmen in Italy. That was optioned for a stupid amount of money, but didn't get made. And then the one that won at the International Screenwriters Awards was a film called Without President, which was about a gang in London who they're doing a heist on a bank, and it all goes wrong, and they accidentally kidnap the President of the United States.
Oh, jeez.
I can send you I had to pitch it in 1 minute to an audience of producers and writers, and I think that's a file on my computer. I can probably send it to you.
Oh, that'd be brilliant.
Oh, wow.
They sound really awesome. I mean, when we had Peter Atkins on the
I heard him. I heard him. That was brilliant. Oh, Peter.
Oh, yeah. Forgot. Peter told me to tell you, say hey. He said hey to you.
Oh,
I talked to him through email, and he wanted me to say he was looking forward to this episode and hope you were doing well.
Nicest man in cinema, that man.
Yeah.
Great guy. Love him to Pete. I mean, you know, he's just a nice guy, you know, nice, you know, and I wish I'd had time and every circumstances have been different so I could have gotten to know him.
He's an excellent conversationalist, and he's very generous with his time. The reason why I brought him up was because he told us that when you're a screenwriter, you make a lot of money if you sell one of your stories as option, and the movie is made, that's better. But sometimes they just option, but the movies don't get made. But you still get the money. So he's like, that's mostly like what screenwriters get, is a lot of their money comes from scripts being optioned, not necessarily to make a movie. But, you know, that's how the industry
is. Yeah, that is absolutely the case in Los Angeles. It's not the case in Oxford.
Yeah, right.
The film industry in America is an industry. I seem to remember reading maybe 15 years ago that I think film was America's second largest export after weapons. It's a huge industry. In England, we're a cottage industry. It's not connected. Finance for movies is limited, slow budget, and it's I won't say it's not professional, but it's a different. It's a different industry entirely. And there was a point where I thought of moving to Los Angeles. I was working. I had optioned some children's books based on Dracula, and they were reoptioned by a company called Klasky Supo, who were the animation company behind The Simpsons, or one of the companies.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time over in Hollywood thinking I was going to be one of the wealthiest men on the planet. And it was pitched to Fox, and it came second, and there's no place for second in the TV industry. You've either got what there's only one Friday night slot, if you will. So it didn't happen. But yes, at the time I was paid quite well. There was lots of money floating around, but that is the industry that's in the States, and that's why Pete, I guess, operates. If he was trying to do the same work as he does in the UK, he'd probably find it more difficult. But tell you what, next time he comes over to England, I'll meet up for a pint with him and we can have a chat about it.
That's brilliant. I think he's going to enjoy listening to you saying that.
Yeah. You'll probably get an email. He said he's been listening to this, so.
Yeah, that's cool. One of my best, one of my best moments was on I was going to say a film called Nightbreed. Like, you don't know about it, but I'm talking to three geeks, aren't I?
Yes.
It's all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, me and Ryan and another friend created Occupy Midian that pushed for the release of the director's cut. So, yeah, it was a lot of work, but it paid off at the end. So that was wonderful to be in L.A. with Clive Barker in the room and see the director's cut being projected. That was a fantastic experience.
Oh, I bet. It was amazing, amazing. But yeah, I had a lovely. There was one time on the film set of Midian, where it was all rope ladders and rope bridges and everything else. And I remember just standing there, and it was just me and Pete looking down. Obviously, we weren't filming at the time. Well, I don't even know. I can't tell you. Obviously, 30 years ago, I can't remember what the hell we were talking about. But it was just a nice, normal conversation that had nothing to do with media or the film industry or money. It was just, oh, this is nice. I like this man. I'll go for a pint with him any day of the week.
I know that there were a lot of people who worked in the movie that ended up as extras in background scenes. Did you ever end up in the set somewhere in like a scene? Because I know Peter did.
No, I didn't. I was going to bullshit you a bit and say I played Decker with the mask on three scenes.
You should have done that.
Yeah, I should have done that. Just see what happens. It would have set the world alight.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about the work you did on the Pelequin makeup?
Pelequin. Oh, my God, what a nightmare. So as I said, I wasn't a makeup artist. I was an artist, a designer, and I also knew about engineering, but I didn't. I was not a prosthetic makeup artist, and so the box was a natural thing for me to do because it was art and engineering. Excuse me. The Pelequin mask, not the Pelequin mask, the Decker mask, was great because it wasn't a prosthetic appliance. It was something that you put over your head and did the zip up. So those I was very comfortable with. When it came to Pelequin, I was excited by what I designed. It was my first model was about 2 foot tall, and it was a very athletic, not strong, not overly muscular, but athletic, fast creature. And the idea was always that this was a sleek and fast abomination, if you will, that didn't rely on strength. It just relied on pure speed and athleticism. And so I was really happy with the design. Clive very much influenced the markings once I'd started on the actual face design. In fact, I think he came up with a paintbrush and started bloody doodling all over my work.
sounds like
yeah, that was typical. Yeah, so he was great on that. But the mistake we probably made, it may not have been a mistake, but it felt like one person is, it was that we decided that it'd be really clever to use compressed air to put a small tube in each tentacle, so that it worked a little bit like you've all seen the a film where there's a hose pipe with water coming out and the hose pipe whizzes all about the place because of the pressure of the water. Steve Martin, I think, did a film, didn't he? Steve Martin. It was Roxanne. There's a fire engine, but we're probably not talking about films you've ever seen now. Anyway, so we decided this would work with compressed air, and it did, but it meant that not only did we have to sculpt each tentacle cast each tentacle, we then had to feed tubing into each tentacle.
So they'd have to be hollow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's where the engineering part comes in.
Yes. It worked. But it was a nightmare. The guy had to wear Oliver Parker, who played Peliquin.
Mm-hmm.
He had to wear a small compression valve on his back. It's before the days of health and safety, so there's a lot of compressed air going into this thing. And they did work. They flipped. They could have taken your eye out. But the work that had to be put in, so rather than just taking a foam tentacle and letting it hang there, would have been probably fine. He could have just flicked his head and like a L'Oreal advert, and it would have been fine. We decided, no, we want compressed air. My right hand, my wingman at the time, was a youngling called Paul Spiteri, who went on to do a lot of the Harry Potter films, I think, recently. And the poor guy, he was stuck there till the early hours of the morning doing this with me. But it was a nightmare. But at the end of the day, Peliquin turned out to be something I'm quite proud of as a design.
It's one of my fan favorite for sure.
Yeah,
a lot of people have them as their favorite Nightbreed. It's a very striking design.
Yeah, thank you.
So we have a question from Esther. She actually sent in a voicemail, so I'll play that.
Hi guys, this is Esther Mullings. Hi Ryan, hi Jose, hi Rob, and hello Simon. Just a question to you, Simon. I was just wondering if there was something out there in this big wide world that you'd love to get your teeth into, using your fabulous mind as it is. something you haven't got round to doing, or something that's been approached to you and you're really looking forward to doing, something that really sort of challenges you, and who, and anyone out there that you would love to work alongside with and who you admire. That's it, really. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, okay, that's a big question, isn't it? Right. In terms of, yeah, things I'd like to do. I'd have liked it if either of my films had been optioned and been made. That would have been nice, and I might find a way of at least publishing the scripts and see if that can do something. I've also written a children's book called The Knit Before Christmas, which is about a knit. Do you call them knits in the States, these things that go in children's hair?
Oh, yeah, like the blouse.
So The Knit Before Christmas is a children's story, and it's about a knit that basically goes round with Santa Claus, and as Santa Claus is laying presents at one end of the bed, the knit jumps off and lays eggs in the heads of the children. As he's going out.
Where exactly is this knit cuddling with Santa Claus? In his beard?
He pings. I don't have it to hand, but I think the first line it was something like, it was the night before Christmas and Santa awoke with a scalp sort of itchy, so he gave it a poke. So it goes on from there. And so that's an ongoing saga, something I'd like to work on. I mean, this is probably total nonsense, I don't know, but I was approached only 24 hours ago by a Canadian company that had doing a low-budget horror film and have asked if I'd be interested in designing the key masks, horror masks for that. So, again, that's, again, nice. Something. After the film industry, I moved away. So, as I said, I worked with, in Formula One, I worked on a car called the BMW LMR, I was part of the design team for the car, and it won the Le Mans 24-hour race.
Oh, that's fascinating. In 1999?
Well, Dan, you're quick on that Google.
Yeah. My Google foo is very strong.
Yay.
I'm looking at the car right now. It's beautiful.
Yeah, so I worked on the air intake system and the braking system on that. And if you Google the LMP, which is the Le Mans prototype, you might see it in black. I don't know if there's any photographs. I've got a photograph, which I'm quite happy to scan and send over to you.
I've seen the LMP in black. It's very, very sleek and sexy.
Yeah, it's like a Batman car.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We'll add this one to the show notes for sure.
So going back to Esther's question, yeah, I'm pretty much open to anything. I suffer from stage 4 cancer, which I was diagnosed with 3 1/4 years ago, had the wonderful experience of being told you've got 2 years to live, which is one of those lines you only hear in films. And so you kind of come away and you kind of go, right, okay, 2 years, what are we going to do? And in fact,
turn it up to 4 years and then 6 years and then 8 years.
8 years. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
You're working hard.
Yeah, we're working on it. So we're like what, 3.25 years out. Yeah, so we're doing well. We're enjoying it. I've just gone through my 46th chemotherapy cycle, and it tires you out, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't apply yourself to projects and work. So the film company in Canada, for instance, I said, fine, you've got to understand that you need to send me the head cast of the actor. I'll do the sculpting and that's it. You know, then it goes off to some genius like John Schoonerad to do the molding and everything else, and it will go off to somebody else to do the prosthetic applications. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways I'm limited, but in others I'm not. So basically I'm up for any creative challenge still. And in fact, the Leviathan producers have asked me to look at the possibility of designing a new box.
It's exciting.
And have asked me to see if I could apply my mind to it. I'll be doing that shortly. But I prioritized.
Certainly, yeah. But just wondering if we're still good with time. I have pretty much covered everything that I wanted to ask. But you guys have any more questions?
I just have one more. I was curious if you ever were approached to do Hellraiser 3, any be involved with the Hellraiser series after Hellbound.
No.
Okay.
I think the I think Hellraiser 1 and 2 were where Clive was involved and where it stayed involved. I really wouldn't have wanted to work on a Hellraiser film without Clive.
Mm. Yeah.
You got to remember that when we did all the Hellraiser designs and work, this was not a corporate studio environment. We were sitting in Clive's kitchen with big sheets of paper, and Jeff or Little John or Nigel or myself would be big black marker pens, and we'd be what's called in the advertising, we'd scamp, which meant we would just get big black markers and just draw anything pretty much. And so the original sketches of Pinhead all came out as very dirty, just quick and cheap sketches. And I think that was something that carried on through Hellraiser 1 and 2.
It
definitely carried on through Nightbreed. And, of course, basically the core group who were behind 1 and 2 had all left Image Animation by 3.
Yeah.
And so, no.
I was just curious if that were you were approached.
It's not something I don't. I was disappointed with some of the redesigns of the box. And I was disappointed that my box was marketed. Letters of authenticity signed by somebody else, which strange.
That was strange. I mean, I think I have a piece of cinematic history, which is the Lylesburg medallion from Nightbreed, which actually, when I got it, I found out was made out of a section of sawed-off PVC pipe. that's movie props for you. But the certificate actually came signed by Bob Keane. So, I'm hoping that is the real signature. So I do have a little bit of a prop from Nightbreed. But yeah, it's weird that, someone else would sign certificates about the box if they didn't design it. I think that's not a cool thing to do, really.
Have you got one of the pencils used in Nightbreed that was signed by Bob Keane?
No.
Hold on. I'm signing it now.
Okay.
There you are. Right. I've just written Bob Keane on this pencil.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. I'm gonna send that to you.
Hopefully. Luckily, I got a third party confirmation from someone who worked in Nightbreed, and they said, "Yeah, that looks like the one we did. Yeah, that looks like a real prop." So.
Bob is my eldest son's godfather.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really? He lives, I think, in
Texas?
Greensboro. Does he live in Texas now? Because he was teaching at the University of North Carolina School of Arts here. I live about 3 hours from where he was teaching in Greensboro, North Carolina. But if he might have, yeah, he probably, I guess he's moved.
Yeah. Maybe. Unfortunately, we don't stay in touch. The falling apart of Image Animation was a bit like the falling apart of a rock band, if you will, going back to what my early analogy was.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it could have been helped. You've got to, you're talking about a bunch of 27, 28-year-olds who are all creative with egos, not quite sure how they got together in the first place.
Yeah.
And we all know that at some point is going to probably implode or explode or do something.
I guess people move on to other projects and they have other opportunities and they follow their dreams in other directions, I guess.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I mean, God, you look at the people who are part of Image Animation. You got Mark Coulier with his two Oscars.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You got Louise Rosner. Louise Rosner doesn't get mentioned in anything. And it would be wrong to say she was my PA. Is anybody Googling quickly?
I'm sorry, what's the name again?
Louise Rosner, R-O-S-N-E-R.
Okay, yes, she's on Internet Movie Database. Here it is. If it's the same person, she's a producer and production manager known for The Hunger Games,
Hunger Games
Catching Fire, and Mean Girls 2004.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, serious.
Huh.
It's fabulous. The Hunger Games is a great franchise, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly. And to be executive producer on that.
That's amazing.
And so she was Chris Figg's assistant on Hellraiser, and then she, when I was made managing director of Image Animation, she was essentially my assistant, I guess. Mm-hmm. I might get sued by a law firm in Los Angeles now, but yeah, it was a bit.
Well, in some ways, listening to the Leviathan documentary, I kind of got the idea from what Bob Keane was saying, that even though a lot of people, like you were mentioning, were not particularly into the whole movie special effects world, but that they got brought into image animation. And the fact that some people were a little lost kind of helped them to discover new ways of doing things and innovate. And so that's what image animation's biggest strength was the fact that I think it innovated a lot because people were trying to come up with different ways of doing things.
Yeah. I think image animation could have been on the edge of doing something amazing. It's something that I always look back on and think, could we have done it differently? I mean, Clive Barker phoned me at home when I resigned. And basically asked if I would reconsider. And I couldn't. And I had I had a list of, I don't know, maybe 5-10 things which made it unworkable. I've long ago thrown away the list, but still can't quite remember. But I know that it didn't work. It wasn't working, and it was just one of those things, and I'm sure that there's, as I said, lots of 1980s rock bands that kind of go, well, why did we break up, you know? But it's just not always that easy. You're talking about, not including me, you're talking about some pretty talented people out there.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, we've gone to Oscars, and you go Little John, now senior sculptor at Madame Two Swords. I'm amazed when I occasionally Google some of the people we brought in, and then look at what they've gone on to achieve. You kind of go, wow. So maybe image animation did that. Maybe that's what it did. It because of its open access policy to young, talented craftsmen who didn't necessarily have any history in the film industry, it allowed them to enter the film industry, spread their wings, and do actually better things than we did, maybe.
Or go into engineering and help, you know, design cars for Formula One.
Yeah. Or write the nip. Or write the nip before Christmas.
Yeah, there you
go. Christmas. Yeah. So, gosh, I guess, you know, I think we got everything in this one episode here.
Conversation.
Absolutely. I would say that this is going to be a great episode. And
yeah. And thanks so much for joining us.
Yes. Taking the time out.
No, thank you, all three of you, for taking the time. Yeah, it's very much appreciated that you appreciate what we did. And
Absolutely.
And, I think all of this stuff is going to be still influencing pop culture and movie culture even after
We're all gone.
Yeah. Well, I'll try and hang on for at least a couple of weeks because Pete Atkins can buy me that pint.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Okay.
I'm going to email him right now. Tell him that. Hold him to that.
Okay, yeah. Guys. Thanks. All right. Thanks an awful lot.
Take care.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. I hope you're doing well, and let's stay in touch. All right. Thank you.
Good fight.
God bless. Bye.
Bye.
The Clive Barker Podcast, or BarkerCast, is an independent editorial fan site and podcast that is not affiliated with or under contract by Clive Barker or Seraphim Films. This podcast and site are a labor of love by the fans for the fans. News, features, and show notes for this episode can be found at www.clivebarkercast.com. Go to iTunes and please leave us a review. Reviews really help us get the word out about Clive Barker. You can also find us on Podomatic, Xbox Music Store, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, DoubleTwist, BlackBerry, and Pocket Cast. We have a Facebook page, so come on and like our Facebook page and join the Occupy Media group for lots of discussion about Nightbreed and other Clive Barker stuff. On Twitter, we're at BarkerCast and at Occupy Midian. Opening theme by Mark Buckle.